They haven't been in a while. When were we there? Was it 4 years ago? I think, I said. Gas, he said. Time flies. My jaw was clenched. I had begun to feel faint and frighteningly insubstantial, as I had in the car the other night, as I had on the street corner the day I met Jane. I need to sit. I rested on a stone wall bordering a neighbor's field. Eddie stood looking at me. You all right? He said lightly, distractedly, as though he neither needed nor expected an answer. When I swallowed, my throat felt swollen. I'm okay, I said. I just got lightheaded. He sat down beside me and put his arm around my lower back and gazed out towards the bay, which was half in cloud and half in a low sun. He said not another word. I could feel him sturdy beside me in that way of his, self-evident and unafraid. I tried to steady myself. I let my head rest on his shoulder and stared out at the view, that scoop of earth between the mountain and the bay, with its tufts of trees and its geometry of fields, the hay sheds and the new dormers and the dank little cottages. The minutes passed. Colors came and went in the sky. I thought maybe the time had come, that he was inviting me to come clean, and the temptation to do so was enormous. Maybe this was my chance, and I should take it. Maybe there would be a worse price to pay if I didn't speak now. But I was too exhausted by secrecy, by the guilt and all the unwelcome power that came with it, to judge whether confessing was the wise thing to do, or whether now was the time. I had begun to believe that Eddie knew something was going on, and knew it was in Dublin. When I'd returned from my last assignation with Collie, he was in the sitting room reading the paper. It was about 9 in the evening. I walked in, and he folded the paper on his lap and stared at me and didn't say hello. What's wrong? I'd asked, because he looked a little shocked. He shook his head as though emerging from some preoccupation. Nothing, he said, but clearly there was something. His tone, it seemed, was intended to suggest as much. The normal thing would be to press him. What is it? But the last thing I wanted was an answer. Nothing, he repeated. Welcome home. I'd spent the days after in a state of paranoia, certain Eddie was observing the signs of strain in me, waiting for me to crack, not wanting to ask me the question either. What is it? Because he didn't want to hear my answer. Let's go home, I whispered. And we rose together and turned back down the lane. It was only when we reached the house and Eddie asked me if I wanted tea that I was struck by the fact that he'd hardly seemed puzzled, or even surprised, by my spell of dizziness and incapacitation. True, he was one of those men who don't ask a lot of questions. In his case, it wasn't narcissism or self-importance, but rather a notion of himself. Was it even conscious? As an anchor. His job was not to get caught up in passing storms or details, but to stay solid and a bit apart. This was one of the things I had first loved about him, the steadiness with which he conducted himself. But that night I found it strange. Eddie was always the first to suggest I see the doctor for some minor ache or pain. And here I'd been faint for no reason, and he hadn't even expressed curiosity, let alone concern. Still, for the rest of the evening, he was exceptionally gentle, solicitous, even in his silence. He was like someone auditioning for the part of my husband. Around 11, he said he was heading up to bed. The announcement felt loaded. It was a night we might have made love. The mood was like that. An off-kilter intensity that seemed poised to tip towards the erotic. I felt he wanted to claim me, and I was surprised by a flush of desire. Something illicit seemed to course between us. I shifted on the sofa and thought of calling him over to me, having him right there, hungrily and fast. Then I thought of Collie, and I couldn't do it. Good night, I said. I'll be up later. He tossed a magazine on the chair and left the room. I stayed up for a long time that night. I turned off the lamps and sat there in the dark, and a feeling of deadness came over me. I don't mean that I felt numb, but that I felt posthumous, as though I were surveying it all from on high. This life that no longer had anything to do with me, I thought of an evening some weeks before when I'd come home from Dublin. I had been with Collie that day. I still smelled of him, and I'd sniffed at my own skin like an animal. On the days I'd been to his place, I felt sly and almost predatory afterwards, plugged into the world in a whole new way. It wasn't that the world had changed, but that I was sensing more of its aspects. I looked at men differently, and they did the same to me. The air hummed with arousal, as though they knew what I'd been up to, and I felt initiated and vaguely criminal, on the other side of some line where I understood myself better and felt the worse for it. Back at home that evening, I had sat on the brick step on the edge of the rockery, where the strawberry vines spread like tiny fingers in the dirt. The air was balmy, and there was a wash of light from the west, a peach-colored sun sinking below the firs that blocked our house from the road. I had wanted to get to the house before Eddie did. I'd felt the need to present myself to it. Not quite to prostrate myself, but something not far from it. I'd wanted to walk into our home and feel forgiven, the way one feels when with animals or children, as though innocence were a contagious thing and reacquiring it as simple as being in its presence. My mother loved sunsets. She considered them events. She liked to place herself at a certain beachside cafe near her condo and watch the sun disappear. Sometimes we did this when I visited her, though I had little interest in sunsets, and to my subsequent regret often told her so. "I don't get it," I would say. "Why anyone would ever take a picture of a sunset? It's not like you capture anything of the splendor. It's not like it isn't going to happen again tomorrow." She would shake her head and smile wryly. "You never know when the world will end." "Well, if it does," I'd say, "nobody's going to be looking at their photo albums." What was wrong with me, raining on her parade like that? My mother gazed at the horizon with a look of rapture, and I sat there parsing the experience for value. One evening, not long after Stan's death, something in me shifted. We were sitting in our usual place, on high stools at the cafe, overlooking the beach and the gulf. As the sun was sinking, a long, washed-out crimson band appeared above the line of the horizon, throbbing faintly, like a heartbeat. As we watched, the colors appeared to intensify, as though the sun might flare and ignite. I glanced at my mother, who was watching it all with an air of beatific calm. So at home in the world, and still so capable of awe. I wondered how Stan's death had changed the tenor of such moments for her. Whether these everyday majesties had intensified or been diminished. I looked back towards the horizon just in time to see a green flash as the sun vanished beyond the curve of the earth. My mother gasped, and I was speechless in the face of the sheer, soundless spectacle of the pulsing world. After that, I tried to make a point of watching the sunset, even if only from the driver's seat of my car, to be mindful of the colors the sky assumed on any given evening. In Nairobi, I was often on my way home from work. It was always around 6:30, that time of day when the heat seemed to draw, like a tide, back into itself. It became like a call to prayer, that hour, a time when I began, ritually, to think about my mother. Minutes in which the whole of our history came to me in the form of a mood, as love is a mood, so that everything was colored, briefly, by the knowledge of her existence. Stan's death knocked her sideways, not just emotionally, but mentally. She grew anxious and forgetful. She was overwhelmed by the smallest things. She became fixated on the plus-minus button on her old Nokia. She believed this was the key to keeping the device working. I told her again and again that this was only the volume control. She said that when she pushed the button, she got a little green door. "Yes," I said. "The green bars are for volume." "But now it's disappeared," she would say, sounding almost panicked. "Yes," I would say. "When it's not being adjusted, it won't stay on the screen." She was also obsessed with charging her phone. Though she very rarely used it, she became nervous if it was away from the charger for even an hour. Throughout that period, which she mostly emerged from, the confusion of grief lifted and she regained her equilibrium. I alternated between great frustration and the feeling of falling in love with her, over and over again. I felt a deep, almost unbearable pity for her humanity. When she died, 2 years after San's death, I kept certain things. Odd things I wouldn't have expected, including that flip-top phone. When I look at it, I see her snapping it smartly shut. A misleading air of mastery, some trace remnant of the years when she was young and strong and sure of herself. During her dying, which I mark as having begun in the late spring of last year with the sequence of mini-strokes, I used to think of hairline fractures spreading like veins across an ice sheet. Now what I think of mostly is how small she got. How I could have lifted her and carried her, loose-boned and limp, as though from a battlefield. One of the strokes happened when I was with her. We were pottering about the house, deciding whether to go to the beach or not, when she began to speak in a kind of mashed-up English. I looked at her, expecting her to right herself. Occasionally, in playfulness, she made nonsense sounds to indicate something hardly worth going into. "Yada, yada, yada," she'd say, and roll her eyes. But this was different. She didn't seem to know what was happening. She stood before me, perfectly clear-eyed, perfectly steady, speaking gibberish. She was like a person possessed, and for the short time she remained in the grip of this, I was stricken with the knowledge that there was nothing on earth I could do to reach her. It passed. The nurse came. She made my mother an appointment with her doctor for the following day. For the rest of that afternoon, my mother was lucid, but so cold that she shivered for hours. I brought her blankets and made her cups of hot tea. She was like someone who'd descended frostbitten from high altitude, the chill gone so deep in her it had to work its way out. I sat on the edge of the bed. It looked like there was nothing but a few sticks under the blanket, arranged haphazardly. When I lifted the covers to put heavier socks on her, she raised her head slightly to watch. Some days before, she had banged her calf on the coffee table, and a purple-black bruise had spread violently on the surface of her skin. "Talk to the doctor about that, too," I said. She said vaguely, gazing at the leg with bemusement, as though it were not of her. The next day, she seemed herself again. She said I should stop fussing. I was making her feel like an invalid. "I'm old," she said tartly. "Things happen." When I asked her if this particular thing had ever happened before, I'd already noticed she didn't like to use the word stroke. She said, "Not that I know of." She said it with such false nonchalance I felt sure she was lying. She sent me out for a few groceries. It was a test. In order to pass, I had to show that I was not afraid to leave her alone. She needed to know this. She told me to take the car, but I wanted to walk, much to her bafflement. My mother was not lazy, but she was very American in ways, and viewed any walking that was not solely for pleasure as somehow debasing or even dangerous. All up and down the street, the buildings were pink and yellow. The sky was a sharp periwinkle blue. There were no clouds, nor was there a breeze. I heard no human voices. Enormous palm trees shaded the big, wide boulevards. The only movement was the slow glide-by of huge sedans and SUVs. A curious, unearthly calm blanketed the neighborhood. At a random point, the sidewalk ended, and I trudged the grassy verge, feeling conspicuous, as though I were a refugee or a fugitive. When I returned to my mother's, laden with more than I'd intended to buy, she cooed over me as though I had survived some grueling journey. They made us lunch, and afterwards she sat in her soft chair in the living room with a crossword on her lap, watchful and mostly silent. She seemed different, remote, detached, and I worried that this was not a fleeting mood, but the result of damage to her brain. In myself I observed a peculiar unease, a feeling that I'd trespassed on her deepest privacies by witnessing the indignity of her befuddlement. What was surely a milestone in her progress towards death. The days or weeks between meetings with Collie were spent in a state of nervous anticipation, in which I wished, desperately, to be assured that I was gambling wisely and well. I would fall prey to the fear that our next rendezvous would surely be the moment when the whole thing went flat before our eyes. Then the day would come, the minutes ticking towards his appearance until, finally, there he was. And always there was a sense of, it is hardly too strong a word, horror. Not horror at him, exactly, but horror at my own foolishness. That I had allowed the effects of this thing to become so disproportionate to their cause. I suppose they were unavoidable, those moments of deflated rapture. On one of these occasions, we were to meet in a pub on Chatham Street. Dublin still felt like a foreign country to me, exotic and perilous, and with a language and customs all its own. I couldn't get a clear sense of it, all the leafy squares and the Georgian grandeur, and at the same time something recalcitrant and primal. The side streets still with a tenement-era reek about them. I made my way on foot from Connolly Station, crossing the river and stopping at a newsagent's on Grafton Street. As I came out, a skinny young man strode past me, his eyes doing a sweep of the crowd. He had a filthy blanket clutched at his neck like a cape, and such an air of purpose about him, he looked like a dystopian superhero. Colley was in the pub when I arrived. It was almost 6 p.m., late in August. Grotty light streamed in through the stained glass. I saw him before he saw me. He was reading a magazine, one leg crossed over the other, a pint on the table. Whatever way the sun was hitting him, he looked practically translucent. It spooked me. I had my usual moment of doubt, but stronger this time, and different in kind. A sudden, stark dread. A shiver passed through me, a tickle at the top of my spine. I could have been staring at a stranger. For a split second, I thought that I was capable of it after all, of letting him go. In fact, I felt like fleeing. I actually considered it. I saw myself going straight back to the station and getting on the next train west. Collie looked up, too quickly, and caught my expression. This was normally the point at which the horror would soften into a feeling of uncertain alarm, and then into shyness. When I would go to him, and he would put his arms around me and rub his rough cheek gently against mine, a creaturely gesture I adored, and the doubt would evaporate. None of that happened, though. He didn't rise to reassure me. Instead, I saw alarm in his own eyes and knew that my expression had given me away. I walked over to him. "What's wrong?" he said, standing. I said something about colliding with a junkie. "Oh," he said, and seemed to relax a little. "Are you okay?" He put his hand on my arm and went to kiss me, and I turned aside and said, "Can you get me a drink?" By the time he came back with my pint, he looked nervous and distant. It seemed that a moment's wavering for me was all it took for his own misgivings to break the surface, for love's false floor to be revealed. It was a terrible evening, the only truly terrible evening we ever had. At dinner, he worked very hard to make conversation, and I sat there, coldly observing him. Finally, he got tetchy. "What is with you tonight?" he said. And I said something stupid like, "I'm not always a laugh a minute." "I don't expect you to be a laugh a minute." "Well then." "Well then what?" "Then let me be." "But why won't you talk to me about it?"
"About what?"
And around we went, until our plates were cleared and he paid the bill. I watched and thought, it's killing him paying the bill. And instead of offering to help, which I always did, an awkward gesture, because of course some of my playing around money was Eddie's, I sat there watching him, pitying him, enjoying his diminishment. A meanness had surfaced in me, and I felt helpless to rein it in. He left an excessive tip to spite me, I thought, and we exited the restaurant in single file, like some old married couple grown sick of the sight of each other. When we got outside, I steered him into the mouth of an alleyway, pushed him up against the wall, and kissed him ardently, a kiss that he returned in kind. "Let's go to my place," he said, a fistful of my hair in his hand, his lips thick at my ear. When we got to the bedsit, it felt all wrong. Everything that had moved me, the humble collection of dress shirts hung with such care, the accoutrements of creativity and the quiet heroism of artistic struggle they bespoke, the very neatness of the place, now struck me as simply sad. All I could see was cheap cabinetry and curtains that needed cleaning. We tripped towards the bed and had raunchy, untender sex, the kind that would have thrilled us had we not been in the grip of resentment. Afterwards, I curled into a ball and cried, feeling sloppy and tragic, while he lay there staring at the ceiling, scratching lazily at his chest. In the morning, I woke sticky with the heat. The usual sounds were rising from the street. I put on one of Collie's shirts and sat up in front of the window and peered out at grubby Rathmines. Dublin is miserable in the rain, but unambiguous sunlight doesn't flatter it either. It's a city that is at its best under florid, tumultuous skies, or at sunset on a summer evening, when the light rolls in low from the west and all the filth is hidden in shadow and the river gleams. Collie wasn't there. He might have been in the bathroom down the hall, or he might have gone out for the paper. He always woke early. I flopped back down on the bed, a film of sex on my skin, and thought of Eddie. I felt as insupportable as it sounds, betrayed by him, for knowing what I was doing and not confronting me, for thinking he could just carry on, blow past it, or wait it out, for letting me stew here in this awful little trap I had built for myself. A wave of nostalgia rolled over me, a yearning for something wholesome, for him. I thought of a certain autumn afternoon. We were on a weekend break at a restored stately home, and we had rented bikes and ridden on a path that followed a river. It was getting near to dinner time, and we decided to forego the 5-course meal that awaited us, going instead to a pub that served steak and chips. A smell of fried food was leaching from the kitchen. 2 men at the next table ate steaks even bigger than ours, holding their knives like pencils and not saying a word to each other, but keeping their faces to their plates, until I thought they'd lick them clean. I think there was a time in this country when no one spoke, just sat there in a savage silence. Eddie and I had to cycle home in the dark. He went in front and warned me if there was a tree root or a bend in the path, and when we finally got back to our hotel, we ordered whiskies and nestled by the fire. 2 people who knew exactly what they meant to each other and reveled in the knowledge. Collie came in with the papers and a pint of milk. When he looked at me, I saw a trace of affection, and I offered him one of those sheepish smiles that stopped just short of an apology. I got up and put the kettle on. We didn't say much. We were both hungover, headachy, and spent. When we brushed against each other, we flinched and said sorry, as though our actual flesh were tender to the touch. We drank Nescafe and cooked rashers on the portable stove, and I nearly forgot that this was where he lived. The room seemed like a stage set to me, provisional and laid on, as though the dishes, the furniture, the tea towels, all of it, down to the box of tissues on the side table, had been arranged for our use and would be stowed again at the conclusion of our run. I had thought, the first time I visited Collie, that he'd imposed order on the place on my account. Later I realized it had nothing to do with me. There was something in it that spoke volumes about Collie, an air of white-knuckled necessity. It was how I imagined a soldier's tent might feel, its order a stay against the outside world, or the inner maelstrom. I felt a strong need to be out of there. I said, "I have an idea. Let's go to Ross's Point." We were sitting at the table, leafing through the papers and gnawing at some toast, my anxiety building. I wanted to leave. But I didn't want to leave Collie. I wanted 2 mutually exclusive things, to flee and to be cocooned, to rid myself of Collie while pulling him close. He looked up from the paper. "What?" "We could stay with Kevin." Kevin, who had introduced us, who knew all about us because Collie had told him. He gave me a frigid little smile and said, in a tone he might have employed with a child, "That sounds like a really bad idea. Why do you want to do that?" "Eddie's in England," I said. "We'll go straight to Kevin's. We won't go into town at all. I want to get out of Dublin." He eyed me steadily. He was right. It was a bad idea. Maybe it was even a test of him, or of us, or of myself. We sat for a while in silence, staring at the tabletop. He was weighing it all up. He was afraid I was leaving him. I could nearly smell the fear off him. And yet I was insisting he come with me, back into the belly of my life. He could either let me go, there and then, and that might be the end of it, or he could say yes and see where I was leading him. "You know I'm nearly skint," he said. "My ticket is for tomorrow. I'll have to buy another anyway. I can buy yours."
"No," he said.
After a minute or two, I got up and began to gather my things. I wasn't going to leave just like that, but I needed to occupy myself. "Let me see what I can do," he said. He got up and went to the hall, where the payphone was, but I didn't hear him speak. "PJ isn't picking up," he said when he came back. PJ was a friend of his, and one of the few things I knew about him was that he had a proper job. I was leaning against the kitchen unit, drinking a cup of water. Collie took the cup from my hand and set it down and put his arms around me. All of the tenderness that had been missing the night before flooded in now. Maybe we saw ourselves coming to an end. Or maybe we thought it was finally getting real. The feel of him was good, and I pressed my hips against his, and he sighed. He let his head fall back, and I nipped gently at his exposed neck. "Okay," he said, and kissed my forehead, and went out to the payphone again. When he came back, he said, "I'll get some cash, and we'll go." And that was how I met his mother. Collie's parents, long separated, were the inverse of that old trope of the Irish marriage, the drama of male misconduct and female martyrdom, often hinging on drink. I never met his father, but I gathered he was a steely, inward-looking man. Collie thought there was a woman he spent time with, but back then, especially down the country, anything resembling life after marriage was viewed as a little shabby or ignoble and wasn't always talked about. Maeve, Collie's mother, was some kind of civil servant. She had left Collie's father some years ago, and though Collie had never said that she'd left him for Tom, the man she was now living with, I sensed that was the case. Collie didn't like Tom, and I think he didn't want to admit that this was the man for whom his mother had thrown away the family. Tom was from Longford, and he owned a breaker's yard out near Swords. I imagined him in a pair of greasy coveralls, enormous oil-blackened hands. Collie's mother, I pictured heavily made up, jagged and slatternly. We had arranged to meet them at a pub in, was it Inchicore? Phibsborough? Terenure? I can't remember. Those places were indistinguishable to me then, blending together in a sea of pebble dash and red brick and illogical traffic flows. I can recall that pub's interior, though, like it was yesterday. It was just after noontime. The August sun was pouring through the open doors like divine light. A smell of stale beer rose from the dark floorboards. Cigarette smoke drifted lazily past. The place was empty but for Maeve and Tom and two older men sitting at a corner table, and all four of them were smoking. Collie and I had taken the bus instead of splurging on a taxi. We'd sat on the very front bench upstairs. I had wanted to sit there for the view. The double-deckers were inordinately thrilling to me. But that day it was all too much. I felt queasy and vertiginous, pitched headlong onto the streets, which vanished in a rolling motion underneath us, as though we were co-pilots losing altitude at a furious rate. Then again, everything felt vertiginous during those days. I had always imagined adultery would feel shadowy and whispered. A world in black and white, all cobblestone and dripping eaves. But what it felt like was being always on the run, everything breathless and fractured and a bit ridiculous. Maeve and Tom were sitting at the bar. Neither of them bore any resemblance to my imaginings. Tom wore a golf shirt and pressed slacks. There was a slight air of the spiv about him, the snake oil salesman. He might once have been handsome, in a hale, seafaring sort of way, but his face had acquired the reddish-purple hue of high blood pressure and dissipation. He struck me as a man slightly ashamed, whose manner of surviving that had been to adopt an awkward bravado, unconvincing even to himself. As for Maeve, she looked much like every other middle-aged Maeve I had encountered,
a sturdy matron in slacks and blouse, and pinned to her heaving bosom an amoeba-shaped brooch. Tom saw us first and called out too loudly, "There they are!" Maeve turned, blew a jet of smoke towards the yellowed ceiling, and looked us over for a moment before saying gently to her son, "Hiya, pet." She gave me a glassy little smile. "And you're Alice," she said, as though assigning parts in a school play. She stubbed out her cigarette and didn't offer her hand. Tom shook my hand, over-eager, compensating for Maeve's coolness. "Sit," Tom said. "Sit. What are you having?" Collie had told me that we would have to have a drink with them, and that he couldn't just borrow money from his mother and leave. So we took the stools beside them, ordered pints, and proceeded to talk about absolutely nothing. I mean, we talked about the traffic that had made us late getting there, and then about some match. I wasn't even sure what sport was at issue. And of course we talked about the weather, though by then the summer's unending sun was a fairly worked-through topic, and the collective sense of wonder had been replaced by feelings of fatigue and unreality. And then Tom said to Collie, "How's the scribbling?" and winked at me. Maeve looked hard at her son. I could tell she took his writing seriously. Collie tipped his head quickly, dismissively, and turned pointedly away from Tom. "You know yourself," he said. "I don't," Tom said. He looked at me. "I loved Shaw as a boy." "You're working hard," Maeve said to Collie. Tom said to no one in particular, "We who tread the boards are not the only players of parts in this world." Collie still refused to look at him. "That wasn't Shaw," he said, sounding bored. I pitied Tom. I think what he wanted was to package up the mixture of admiration and resentment that he felt for what Collie did, this thing that mattered to him and that it seemed he had a talent for, but which made him so little money he had to come begging to his mother, and to deliver it in the form of a cutting aside. But he wasn't clever enough, or sufficiently clear-headed, to pull it off. Maeve was harder to read. I wasn't sure what kind of face I should be putting on. Contrite? Deferential? Ashamed? Or on the contrary, unashamed? I intended to love and honor her son, but could I really do it? I had no idea. I had no idea what I was made of. She asked me a single question. "Are you in Dublin for long?" I fumbled the response. "Heading home today," I said, then attempted to correct myself. "Heading back." The symmetry was making us all a bit queasy. She caught me watching her a few times. The question I wanted to ask was, "What's it like leaving your husband?" She was reserved, wry, vaguely disapproving. They were both disapproving. But it wasn't our affair they objected to so much as it was our happiness, and probably our youth, that we were young enough to believe that whatever we were feeling really mattered. To think that none of this had ever happened to anyone before, not in the way it was happening to us. They resented the flighty, brazen way we were hurling ourselves at life. They resented our ignorance of each other, and ourselves. It wasn't that Maeve and Tom didn't love each other. I think they did. But there was a current of weariness and cynicism running between them. They were deeply, committedly alcoholic, and in on it together. The grim enterprise of being themselves. It wasn't only the drink, though, that dishonored them. It was the legal limbo of the undivorced. They had about them a whiff of statelessness, a fugitive air, and an uncertainty about how much their transgressions mattered. At some point, a signal must have passed between Collie and his mother, because she slipped him a wad of notes, and we all glanced quickly around, as though something crooked were taking place. The whole encounter felt like a burlesque of the classic meeting with a lover's parents, where instead of offering you living proof that love lasts and esteem endures, instead of welcoming you to the land of long-term commitment, they press 50 quid into your hand and tell you to keep your head down. After an hour or so, we made our excuses. Collie kissed his mother on the cheek, and I shook Tom's hand, and half bowed to Maeve, as though she were a cleric. She still seemed disinclined to touch me. And off we flew. I see us running down the street, running as though to catch the last ever bus, running as though we'd just robbed a bank and our whole mad, vibrant lives were about to begin. We weren't actually running, of course. Of that much I'm certain. It was another hot day, and neither of us was the least bit fit. But I remember it that way because that was how it felt. Like we had so much life in us we couldn't contain it. Of course, we were running from ourselves too. No great powers of deduction were required to recognize that we had just been presented with a version of our future. It was the sort of thing Colley might have called, in one of his theater reviews, a gross oversignification. As we tumbled into our seats on the bus, he said, with that laconic jocularity that was his dominant register, "Well, there's us in 30 years. And we laughed with relief, as though the voicing of it had rendered it impossible. I pressed my head into the crook of his shoulder and ran the tip of my tongue slowly up the side of his neck, which was damp with the heat. He stopped laughing and slid a hand between my legs. I put my arms around him and we held each other, with our eyes closed, waiting for the future to recede. By the time we drew away from each other, the shadows of his mother and Tom were gone, and we were only ourselves again. I kissed him hungrily, and then, though there were 2 women about 10 rows back, I raised myself up and straddled him, and we ground slowly into each other. Our encounter with dissipation had only left us feeling lustier and more alive. For a few moments we could not conceive of it, either of growing old, or of seeing our spiritedness, our exuberance, reduced to the sad habit of spending long, bright Saturdays getting wearily blotto. We got off the bus at the station, and from there boarded the train west, the heat waning sweetly, and the air turning pure and fresh, confirming our exit from the sordid city. The world was one big, pathetic fallacy to us, and we had never felt so favored as we did at the outset of that last journey. The sky blue and enormous, the countryside opening like a promised land to receive us. Kevin's house was a humble little place on a quiet laneway in Lower Rosses, overlooking a beach of pure white powder, one of many unsuspecting properties around there that would soon be worth a fortune. The Point was only on the brink of development that summer. The yacht club had long existed, but there were certainly no yachts there. There were not yet McMansions. There was no spa or leisure center. No kiteboarding school. It still had the ramshackle feel of an old seaside village. When we pulled up in the taxi, Kevin opened the front door and ushered us in with downcast eyes and an almost reverential air, as though we were on the run from baleful enemies, and he was honored to offer us safe haven. Before he closed the door, he stared intently out at the taxi, which was idling on the roadside. I could see he was enjoying the part Colley had asked him to play. Kevin worked on building sites. He was a bachelor and a hoarder, and he drank too much. Colley had told me that when they were in their teens, Kevin had, over the course of one summer, progressed from social to often solitary drinking. A couple of years later, a woman he'd hoped to marry left him over it. Kevin had tried and failed twice to get sober. Since then, his life had grown small around him. His eyes were glassy and a little elsewhere. The house was in disarray. In the spare bedroom, where we would stay, as well as piles of discarded clothes, several empty stout bottles, and some faded paperbacks lying every which way, as though they'd been flung aside in disgust, there were 3 large triangles of broken glass from a window or a picture frame, which Kevin had taken care to prop against a wardrobe. He saw me looking at them and said he'd been meaning to remove them. "I'm cooking chops in an hour," he said. "There's plenty." I thanked him, and Colley said, "Cheers, man." He backed out with what was nearly a bow, and Colley and I sat beside each other on the bed. "Do you think he minds?" I asked. "Why should he mind?" Colley said, and I remembered that men were different. Across the room, opposite the bed, was a picture window. We could see in the distance the long mountain that had loomed behind my own house. It looked like a reprimand. I got up and closed the curtains, which were actually lace, pushed Colley back on the bed and lay down beside him. We didn't speak. It felt as though we were both waiting for something to happen. We were here. Now what? Kevin served lamb chops and mashed potatoes, and we ate outside, and afterwards sprawled in the front yard, drinking cans of Heineken, or dinner plates scattered like frisbees on the grass. The air had cooled, and we smoked lazily and stared up at the sky. I reached over and ran my finger along the curve of Collie's jaw. He let his head loll to the side, and we gazed at each other until I couldn't take it anymore and turned away. Just after 8, we rose drowsily, and Collie suggested walking to the beach for sunset. Kevin said he'd do the washing up, but we made him come with us. We were trying to feel it wasn't wrong, what we were doing, that we were just 3 friends knocking around, and we wanted it to look that way. We headed down the lane, and then along the path, till we got to the 3rd beach just as the sun was sinking. We could see Lissadel across the inlet to the north and, to the west, the bay opening out into the Atlantic. There were whitecaps in the distance. I put on a pair of red-lensed sunglasses I had found on the floor in our bedroom. They made a few clouds on the horizon, which, to the naked eye, looked grey and tufty, like what you'd see along the skirting boards of an unswept room. Glow like hot coals, or swirling lava, what I imagined the end of everything might look like. When we got back to the house, a grainy twilight hung in the sitting room. Collie got cans from the fridge, and the 3 of us sat talking till late. Collie and I curled up on the sofa. We had never been in a house together. We had never displayed ourselves so openly as a couple. We felt drained and content, as though this happiness were an actual accomplishment of ours. We were self-satisfied and insular, radiating benevolence, but interested, really, only in ourselves. My marriage, Eddie, the home we shared, those things barely impinged. Honestly, it was as though I thought I could forget my life, collapse it like a piece of furniture, and stow it for the season. In the morning, Collie and I woke to the chirping of birds. We could feel a light breeze through the open window, and the freshness made the room look all the more sordid. For whatever reason, we had not seen fit to move the triangles of broken glass to a safer spot, and we were lucky that in our nocturnal stumblings to the bathroom, we had not gored ourselves. Collie christened the room the City of Glass, and naming it seemed to domesticate the danger. We made coffee and stayed in bed till noon. We talked about everything but the situation we were in. We talked about the summers he'd spent in Sligo as a child, and about his mother and my father, and all the ways people fuck up their children, even when they're not bad people. We talked about whether we drank too much, and then about the script he was writing, a black comedy about an Irish thug in Marbella who ends up raising a little girl, which sounded to me like a remake of Paper Moon. We talked about books, too, or he did, for Collie was far better read than I, about Philip K. Dick and Borges, and other writers I knew nothing about. And we talked about love. He quoted something from the letters of Catherine Mansfield about how she thought that romantic love was the act of faith that had replaced God, and that what we wanted from the beloved was to be known as we once believed God knew us. He looked at me to see if I agreed, or if this was what I expected from him. "You've read the letters of Catherine Mansfield?" I asked. "More or less," he said. When we heard Kevin moving about, we dressed and went to join him. We found him standing in the middle of the kitchen, scratching his head and looking around him like he'd never seen the place before. The tap was turned on full. Collie shut it off. There was an open can on the table, which I thought was from the night before until Kevin picked it up and took a long swallow from it. Collie backhanded him gently in the gut and said, "I'll make us some breakfast." After breakfast, we sat around in the shade of the small back patio, reading bits to each other out of a week-old Irish Times. Finally, Kevin said he was going to walk over the field to the pub that faced the harbour on the other side of the point, and we said we would go along. We set out buoyantly enough, but the sun was intense, and our initial brisk gait soon degenerated to a trudge. The air wavered in the heat. I was a few steps behind the 2 of them, the sweat rolling off them, and their pale skin so unsuited to the sun I imagined it erupting into blisters right before my eyes. For whatever reason, I thought of Collie in New York. 19 years old. The story he told me about his one stab at the city. I was thinking how out of character it seemed that he'd given up. But maybe that was what was driving him now. Maybe he'd spend the rest of his life making up for it. I was thinking how easily things can go otherwise, how he could be living a life in New York now, instead of schlepping across a field with the bay just beyond the rise and me behind him. Upon arriving at the pub, we collapsed dramatically at a picnic table in the gravel yard. It was a Sunday, and in the fine weather, the place was packed. Of course, we saw people we knew. But we seemed to think we were invisible. Invisible as lovers, at least, because we had Kevin as a foil. And because no one looked askance at us. And no one asked where Eddie was. I still didn't get it. How much was observed, but unspoken. And how little relation whatever did get said bore to what was known or surmised. And so we made merry, digging our own graves and smiling all the while. It wasn't late, maybe 8 o'clock, when we got a lift back to Kevin's. I went into the bedroom and lay down on the tangled sheets. Collie and Kevin were sitting out front on plastic chairs, and I listened to the hum of their voices and felt consoled. I thought, I could do this forever. Lie here, listening to him. Nothing required of me, and nothing wanting. I felt a complete absence of ambition. I mean, even the ambition to go to him. I thought, he is mine, and was astonished by my luck. That was what I was thinking about. My luck. When the phone rang. It took a moment for me to recognize what I was hearing. It seemed like ages since I'd heard a phone ring. But when I realized what the sound was, I was sure it must be Eddie calling. I had phoned our house that afternoon, before we'd gone to the pub, and left him a message, knowing he wouldn't be back till the evening. I'd told him where I was. I'd said that a bunch of us had come here for a party, a bonfire on the beach, and that I would be home tomorrow. I had left him Kevin's number. It would have seemed odd not to. Now, I scurried to the entryway and stared at the phone. Kevin ambled in from outside, and when he saw me, he hesitated. "Right," he said, and went back out the door. The answering machine clicked on, and Eddie's voice came through, as crisp and level as a pilot's. He said that he was back, and that he could pick me up, and that I should let him know when I got in. When the message ended, I went into the kitchen and fished a can of Heineken out of the fetid chaos of Kevin's refrigerator, and sat there in the semi-dark. My heart racing from the shock of Eddie's voice. I imagined phoning him and saying, "Yes, do, come for me," and slipping out the kitchen door, and back to him, now, quietly, before it was too late. And in the next moment, all I wanted was to hide, to never leave this house or go back to that one. I thought maybe it could be as simple as drawing a line under one life and beginning another. I heard Collie and Kevin coming into the sitting room from outside. Collie called my name, then wandered into the kitchen and said, "What are you doing in the dark?" He stood behind me and rubbed my shoulders, and a wilting sensation came over me. But when I didn't answer, he stopped. He leaned closer and whispered, "What's going on?" "Nothing," I said. I put my hand over his and didn't look up.
"Nothing?"
Eddie phoned. His grip on my shoulder slackened. "Just leave me for a bit," I said. Kevin came in then, and Collie straightened and mumbled something to him. Kevin said something back, and opened the fridge and got them each a beer. Then they left the room, quietly, and with an almost professional discretion, as though my marriage were a medical condition I was better off attending to in private. Until the moment I heard his car in the drive, it hadn't occurred to me that Eddie would come to Kevin's. I was still sitting in the kitchen, and Kevin and Collie were in the front room. I got up to go outside. I didn't want Eddie coming into the house. And the two of them watched me cross the room, as though they were seeing a ghost. I met Eddie in the drive, and we stood looking at each other. He tipped his head towards the car and said, with no particular inflection, "Come home. Looks like the party is over." When I didn't say anything, Eddie walked to the edge of the drive and peered up the lane, just for something to do. It was a gorgeous evening, balmy air, deep pink skies, a few puffy clouds to the west. I followed him a few steps and sat on the wall that enclosed Kevin's yard. Eddie turned back, but didn't sit. He stood there with his hands on his hips. "Come home," he said again. I hesitated, and to my own surprise said, "What will you do if I don't?" I don't know what I meant by that exactly. I wasn't issuing a challenge, and I don't think I meant ever. Perhaps I wanted him to say, take all the time you need, or to assure me that there would be no consequences. He sighed and looked down at his feet. I could feel Collie in the house behind us. I don't know what I'll do, he said. A car rolled past, slowly, and we both stared after it. I need to gather my things. Okay, he said, and turned towards the car. I want you to go ahead. I'll be there shortly. I'll call a taxi. He turned back to me, irritated. That's silly. Was it? I didn't know any more what we were pretending and what was simply going unsaid. I'll wait, he said, again. And again I said no. I'll be home, I promise. His expression changed then to something like disgust. Kevin's house was nearly dark inside. Collie followed me into the bedroom. The sound of the car grew fainter, then disappeared. Collie tried to turn on a lamp, but the bulb popped. He cursed and switched on the ceiling light, which must have been about 10 watts. What happened? I lied to him. Or maybe I didn't. Because already I wasn't sure I could do what I'd promised Eddie I would. I slipped my arms around his waist, and he returned the embrace, though tentatively. I'm not sure what happened, I said. I don't know what he knows. I said that we'd argued about my going home, and then he'd driven off. Collie waited for me to say more. Poor Collie. He must have felt the weight of it, Eddie's arrival, and his departure. And the fact that I was still here. He pulled me closer and stroked my hair very gently, and although it seems cheap to claim it, I think we felt, in that moment, ennobled. For all the lies and the guilt and the selfishness, we believed this was a situation we were equal to. That we wouldn't leave each other in the lurch. We stood embracing in the gloom, afraid to speak, awed by what we'd done. Just after midnight, I called a taxi from Kevin's phone. Collie was asleep. When I came back into the room, I had to turn on the ceiling light to find my things. Collie woke and sat up in the bed and squinted at me, confused. What are you doing? He said. Are you leaving? I was picking my belongings up off the floor. A hairbrush and underwear, a t-shirt, a skirt, 2 books. How had I scattered so much in such a short time? In the near dark, I nearly walked into the glass propped against the wardrobe. Jesus! Be careful, Collie said. He got out of bed and went to the window and lifted the curtain daintily. He thought Eddie had come back. Seeing nothing, he turned around and shook his head, still half asleep. What the fuck? I stopped what I was doing and stood in the middle of the room, in the middle of the mess, and tried to keep from losing it entirely. Can we talk tomorrow? I said finally. Can you call me tomorrow? He had moved to the bedroom doorway, where he was leaning in the shadows, his arms crossed over his chest, as though he was going to block my path. I wondered if he was capable of that. Why did we come here? He asked. Why did we come here? Yeah, why did we come here? I looked at the floor. I knew what he was accusing me of having delivered us to Eddie, of creating the conditions whereby Eddie could carry me off, like a trophy. But that was crediting me with more forethought and strategizing than I was capable of. If I can say one thing in my favor with regard to those days, it's that I had no idea from 1 hour to the next what I was doing. I said nothing. Anything I said would be the wrong thing, and it wasn't like I knew the answer. I zipped my bag shut. In the bedroom doorway, I stopped and rubbed my cheek slowly over Collie's, which was rough with the need of a shave. One of us moaned softly, and I'm afraid that it was me. When I was a girl, I had a big cutaway doll's house. I used to squat on my haunches in front of it, arranging and rearranging the furniture, thrilling to the sweep of my perspective. Each room in it was like a museum exhibition, the American home circa 1900. Bare floorboards, the furniture Spartan but pretty. Mostly, I felt like the benevolent custodian of my domain. But every so often, on a whim, I would reach in with my giant's hand and cast all of it out upon the carpet. Beds and dressers and chairs tumbling from the upstairs rooms as though the earth had shook, so that I could start again. I felt that urge these last months, or something like it, peering into Eddie's house as though from on high, clicking from image to image, from room to room. I wanted to reach in and rearrange it all, so that when Eddie and his wife came through the door and looked around, they would be suddenly unsure of themselves. I didn't want to haunt them exactly, or to take my husband back. It was more a desire for a rent in the fabric of reality. I thought I saw him today. Eddie, I mean. He was coming out of Buswell's hotel, and he had a little girl with him. She must have been 6 or 7. He was putting a cap on her head while she stared vacantly across the street, with an attitude of forbearance. My heart began to thrum. My palms prickled. My first instinct was to call his name. Immediately after, I thought to turn away. Instead, I stood there, captivated. He was like a memory given dimensions, a dream-made material. I wanted to stare and stare, to stay rooted in the stark sensation of seeing him. And then something in his stance, a turn of his head, and I saw it wasn't him. He took the girl by the shoulders, then buttoned the top button of her coat, and straightened the hat and gave her a little rub on the head. He looked left, then right, and they headed off towards Dawson Street. It hardly surprised me, my mistake. Lately I've been seeing him everywhere. Not thinking it was actually Eddie, as I did this morning, but catching glimpses of him in the profiles and gaits and gestures of other men. I pass a man with a child, and I think about the children Eddie and I didn't have, the ghosts of our unchosen future. I think of the history we didn't accrue, as though it were a country we have yet to visit. I have imagined, in the most absurd and proprietorial way, Eddie in our home, alone, holding down the fort till my return. We camped once, Eddie and I, on a patch of lakeshore near the Leitrim border. When I woke in the morning, a yellowy-green light hung low over the grass, and the sky was a powder blue. The lake was blue, too, smooth as a pane, and along the shore reeds pierced the water's surface. I had never seen such stillness. Eddie hadn't woken yet, and I lay there, looking at the sky, the sunlight spangling the trees, and felt sorry for anyone who wasn't me. I think about that day, and others like it, when I felt at the heart of the world, and wished for nothing more than my life, exactly as it was. I think about why, having found that feeling, I couldn't hold it. There was a week between the day I left Eddie and the day I went to Dublin, when I stayed with Jane in Sligo. One afternoon I bumped into Eddie on Quay Street. If you have ever been married and then separated, I hardly have to tell you how disorienting the first chance encounter is. The shock of meeting each other and not saying the most habitual things about what to pick up for dinner or where the car was parked was such that I felt utterly severed from him. The marriage, our love, the day-in, day-out intimacy of those years felt like a dream we'd had together and remembered only hazily, if at all. I get back to Monkstown around 7 o'clock. It is the first evening of the year when there is a perceptible trace of spring in the air. My time in this house is winding down. I have begun looking for somewhere to rent, probably in town. I will stay for a while, I have decided. I will keep working as a consultant. Last week I got an email from an old friend I knew in Kosovo who'd been asked to go back to Pristina for 6 months to fill a gap. He declined and was writing to see if I'd be interested. When I told Harry about the offer, which I didn't intend to accept, he winced. Harry found Kosovo insistently depressing. He said the entire place, even the open fields, even the sunny days, felt dark and cursed. He said the only good thing about Pristina was that it was the one city in the world where you could say, "I'll meet you on the corner of Bill Clinton and Mother Teresa." I make dinner and read until 10 in the sitting room, then step out back to smoke a cigarette. Overhead, a crosshatch of bare branches against the moonlit sky makes me think of the brain, its axons and dendrites. I hear movement in the darkness, a scuttling in the hedge to the left of me. And then a cat emerges from the shadows. It pauses in the middle of the back garden, its front paw raised, and looks right at me before vanishing into the opposite hedge.